Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. In the spring, we spring forward. In the fall, we fall back. How much simpler can it be, at least in remembering how to adjust our clocks in the annual ritual of daylight saving time? But determining the purpose, origins, and history of this curious phenomenon isn't quite that simple. So we invited Michael Downing to join us this week to help clarify matters. Downing is the author of Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time. Carlene Stevens will follow Michael Downing, commenting on the historical relationship between Americans and time, and Fiona Beatty will wrap things up by telling us about a museum exhibit available virtually as well on time. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at some recent articles in the news you may have missed. First, an update. Several weeks ago, Jared Diamond appeared on Talking History to discuss his theories on the rise and fall of civilizations. Among his several examples was the case of the demise of Easter Island, which he explained as being the result of the deforestation of that island by its native inhabitants. Anthropologist Terry Hunt of the University of Hawaii, Manoa, however, has concluded otherwise. Based on research he has conducted on the island since 2001, he blames rats and Europeans. Diamond argued that natives cut down all of the trees in order to transport the hundreds of 10-ton statues they erected on the South Pacific Island, and that triggered erosion that damaged farmlands, which in turn led to cannibalistic civil war. Hunt's evidence suggests that rats began deforesting the island's 66 square miles of 16 million palm trees even before the island was first settled and finished the job shortly thereafter in the 13th century. Further, Hunt's study of skeletal remains revealed no evidence of warfare among the island's inhabitants until the arrival of Dutch traders in the 1700s. Hunt attributes the loss of population thereafter to disease brought by the Dutch and the new arrivals' slave trade. And on more current history, several chapters of Students for a Democratic Society, the anti-war pro-civil rights group dating to the 1960s, have announced plans to form a national organization, once again, and to hold the first SDS National Convention since 1969. The National Convention is scheduled for the summer of 2006 and is to be preceded by a series of regional conferences occurring on Memorial Day weekend. The newly formed SDS national organization was the idea of student anti-war activists Thomas Good and Pat Court. The first original SDSers to join them was Alan Haber, president of the SDS from 1960 to 1962. And they have a website at studentsforademocraticsociety.org. When we return, I'll be speaking with Michael Downing about the history of daylight saving time. This is Talking History. It's that time again when we engage in the annual ritual of springing ahead 1 hour, where we'll luxuriate in all of that extra sun until the end of October, when we'll fall back into darkness once again, going from daylight savings time to what some call God's time. It's a curious phenomenon, shrouded in mystery as to its origin, history, and even purpose. But our guest this week will help us solve some of those mysteries. He's Michael Downing, the author of Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time. Welcome, Michael.
I'm glad to join you, Brian.
Good to have you. Now, you teach creative writing at Tufts, which makes you a bit of a different guest from most of our guests here on Talking History, who are historians. But I want to tell everyone right up front, this is nevertheless very good and interesting history, and, of course, not surprisingly, very well written. But let me ask you the obvious question. How'd you get interested in the subject of daylight savings time, or perhaps put another way, somewhat humorously, I hope, for most of our listeners, how did a nice guy like you become an historian?
Well, I got interested in daylight saving specifically because of the ritual. That is, it's one of the few things I as a citizen actually do twice a year at the behest of my government, and I realized I didn't understand it. But, you know, my position as a historian, that's really a position of recourse. The fact is, when I started to try to understand why we have daylight saving, what I discovered is that basically all the best creative fiction about daylight saving had already been written by historians and journalists. No one seemed to know where this history came from, and at some point in the popular imagination, the myths and the fiction had simply replaced the history. That's what got me going.
I'm not surprised, because as I read through the book, I thought I had it all figured out about farmers and whatever, and boy, you punctured all the balloons there. I just turned from one page to the other and learned much more about it. But let's go back and see how many of these myths we can clear up. Where did the idea of moving our clocks ahead 1 hour to save daylight originate?
Well, here's the deal. Most cultures have been really bugged by the idea that the amount of sunlight we have across the year is unreliable. The Romans tried to solve this problem by actually changing the number of minutes in the hour as they had more and more daylight, so that by June, the Roman hour was 80 minutes long. So it's an old problem, and people have been trying to solve it for a while. But the real idea, the first noted person to put forward an idea of how to save daylight, really was Ben Franklin in a famous letter he wrote to the Journal of Paris in 1784. Franklin noticed this phenomenon of people sleeping through sunrise, and he proposed that the French fire off cannons to wake up their lazy citizens so they wouldn't waste daylight. That's generally considered the original proposal for daylight saving.
This was like an efficiency move, or?
No, I think in Franklin's mind, it was something of an efficiency move, and also just one of those things that Franklin had noticed, that he loved to identify, essentially, solutions and then try to come up with what problem it was solving.
Okay, so we can't blame this on the farmers, which is what I thought.
It's fantastic that so many of us in this country grew up with the myth that the farmers wanted daylight saving. Here's why it's so interesting. The opposite is true. The single most vociferously opposed constituency to daylight saving in this country's history were the farmers. They hated it from the start. There's a simple reason for that. Farmers were the Americans who actually used morning sunlight, and what daylight saving was designed to do was to shift morning sunlight, which many people slept through, to the evenings where they would actually use that hour of the natural resource. Farmers hated it.
Well, that's very interesting. Farmers get blamed for everything, like the length of the school year starting in September and ending in June or whatever, and now we can take them off the rack on this one as well, so... What's the logic, then, as far as daylight savings time today? What's the logic behind using this?
It was an amazingly elegant and simple idea, and really the credit for the modern idea of daylight saving has to go to William Willett, an English architect. Willett got this simple idea that if you shifted the clocks forward as the day got longer, instead of sleeping through sunrise, which often occurs as early as 4 a.m. in the morning, people would have that extra hour of sunlight in the evening, and it would promote people to use recreation time, to get outdoors, to be healthy. And Willett was something of an evangelical and saw this also as just a way of celebrating God's great gift to us, the sun. It was really nothing more than the beginning of modern idea of recreation.
Does that work for you? Does that logic stand up?
That logic really does stand up. It turns out that altering the clock alters people's behavior. So in the simple way that Willett conceived of it in 1907 when he first proposed it to the British, it really does hold up. Unfortunately, since then, daylight saving has been either blamed or credited with almost every problem and every cure ever known to man. And that really doesn't hold up.
Okay. It's sort of a logical, I hope a logical question to follow. If winter days are actually shorter than summer days, why don't we try to save some daylight during the winter? Why don't we adjust our clocks during the winter to get more daylight in?
This is just the sort of logical question that has plagued both supporters and opponents of daylight saving for more than 100 years. To this very day, congressmen like to talk about daylight saving in terms of how an hour saved will affect us, how an extra hour of daylight will make us happier. Scientists have been telling us that it prevents suicides, that it helps people with seasonal affective disorder. Here's the problem with the equation you're proposing. We can't actually save daylight. And so, when we have the shorter days of winter, shifting the clock forward only means that we have blackness, that is, no morning sunlight, almost until 9:30 or 10 o'clock in the morning. The only time daylight saving works, that is, shifting that hour from the morning to the evening, is when we have these 14 and 15 hour days of summer. So when it seems like we would be saving ourselves a precious resource, the winter, daylight saving doesn't work. The real fallacy at the bottom of your question is that by World War I, daylight saving got conflated with saving energy. And so, of course, it seems obvious we'd save more of that energy in the winter because we use more home heating oil during that time. But the problem is, daylight saving has never saved us anything by way of energy.
Okay, I'm going to have you step through the history in terms of sort of major events in this whole phenomenon. But before we do that, one last question, which is, at least as it originated, and you said the farmers were opposed to this, so who stood to gain the most from daylight savings time?
Two constituencies. The most important supporters of daylight saving were retail stores. At the turn of the century, they were the major economic power in America, and what had happened is that many workers' hours had been regularized by factories and other large production means. So we had workers not buying retail goods during the day. Department stores early on figured out that if we shifted the clocks and gave an extra hour of sunlight to people in the evening, workers would shop on their way home. It was a retail spending strategy. The other big boon to daylight saving came, oddly, from the stock market. That was particularly true in New York because we were 5 hours behind England in terms of time, and we had a 6-hour banker's day. Shifting the clocks ahead for New York stockbrokers kept us up with London, where daylight saving had been adopted, and it preserved an hour of overlap, which, of course, was the hour for arbitrage in the stock market. It was always about money.
Interesting. Okay, let me take you through four times in history where the debate arose around saving daylight time. The first would be World War I. Tell us about that.
World War I really is the onset of worldwide daylight saving. The British had been debating it for 10 years, and when World War I broke out, the Germans got hold of the idea, and before the British adopted it, they put in effect daylight saving in the hope of saving energy. The British immediately followed, and as a result, the Americans followed. So all these countries are springing ahead, hoping to save daylight. It didn't really save anything by way of energy, but it was so fantastically unpopular with the farmers, who were then the most important political constituency in America, that even before the peace is declared for World War I, Congress is forced to rescind the National Daylight Saving Law. It goes away as a national policy at that point. New York City, because of its stock market and department stores, starts a wildcat daylight saving program, and American cities begin to adopt it. But there's no national policy.
Okay. Did we have a replay in World War II?
Absolutely. It's almost the exact same story. Franklin Roosevelt pushes the country onto what he calls wartime, which is essentially year-round daylight saving time. He really sees it not only as a possible energy saver, again, those energy savings don't help, don't materialize, but Franklin Roosevelt and his administration have the idea that by shifting the clock, we'll get civilian and industrial demand for energy to be out of sync enough so that peak loads begin to shift. It's the first introduction of daylight saving for this purpose, this idea of shifting peak loads and preventing blackouts. But immediately, the farmers and many rural communities begin to object, and before the end of World War II, again, the nation has rejected national daylight saving.
Well, this certainly is giving us a different perspective on farmers. Okay, in the mid-60s, we have a bit of a flap again surrounding the Uniform Time Act of 1966. Tell us about that.
It's an amazing moment in our history. We have no national daylight saving policy, but we have 130 cities in America in 1965 with populations over 100,000. 71 are saving daylight, 59 are not. There are so many different time zones that one airline is reporting it's getting 4,000 calls a day from passengers just trying to figure out what time it will be in the city of their destination. We have a famous bus route that becomes a major national issue, 35 miles between Ohio and West Virginia, where in 1 hour of traveling, you have to adjust your clock 7 times to figure out local times. The U.S. Naval Observatory says at that point, the United States has become the world's worst timekeeper. Congress, which has long been afraid to step into the debate because of the opposition of farmers, finally steps in and settles uniform time, which is 6 months on daylight savings, 6 months off for the entire nation.
Well, that was an attempt, anyway, to clear it up. Let's turn to the oil embargo or the energy crisis of the early 70s. It came up again then. Tell us about it.
It did, and daylight saving has a knack for turning its greatest opponents into its greatest supporters. Richard Nixon had actually campaigned on behalf of Republican congresspeople in the Midwest against daylight saving in the 60s. And in 1973, in a desperate attempt to stem the effects of the Arab oil embargo, Nixon becomes the first peacetime president to impose year-round daylight saving time. Of course, this was the very year that Nixon was about to resign from the presidency. He wasn't having a lot of luck. Within 3 weeks of the policy going into effect, pictures of school children begin to be flashed across the nation. Here's what's happened. It's February, and the sun is not rising until 9 o'clock in many communities. And so you have school kids out on trafficy streets in pitch blackness. One or two bus accidents involving school children was enough to make the country call off the experiment entirely. Nixon's plan was shelved.
So we have attempts here, anyway, to make it uniform, but every time we get to spring, or sometimes even in the fall when we fall back, there are inevitably articles in the paper pointing out areas of the country that are still resisting this or not cooperating at all. So this continues, the disgruntledness, and it's still not uniform across the nation?
It's still not quite uniform across the nation. We have one state, Arizona, which has always refused to adopt daylight saving, basically on the idea that it's states' rights versus the federal government messing with their clocks. Indiana has been the famous example of confusion where it has two time zones. Some of the cities in the eastern time zone use daylight, some don't. Some in the central time zone do and some don't. It's a fantastic complication. But here's the deal. Since 1966, we have gotten more and more daylight saving. And there's a reason for that, and that's that the lobby in Congress that has been strongly behind this continues to push for daylight saving, and that's the retail lobby. One simple example. In 1986, Congress gave us an extra month of daylight saving. We went from 6 months to 7 months. The barbecue industry alone, by its own account in front of Congress, said that month of daylight savings was worth $200 to $400 million every year. This is a fantastically profitable enterprise for retailers. For people who oppose it, that just makes it seem like a boondoggle.
Amazing. Well, you mentioned Indiana. That's certainly an issue for us because, as you know, the Organization of American Historians effectively owns this program, and every time we try to call them, sometimes we're on the same time belt, sometimes we're not. I always have to check ahead of time and make sure what time it is before I call, see if they're at the office yet.
It's preposterous because the only virtue of clock time, really, is predictability and synchronicity. Once we don't have that, we might as well put our watches in our pockets.
Okay. I'm going to quote you here and let you defend yourself. This
okay.
is a letter that you authored in January of 2005. And you describe daylight saving time as, and I'm quoting here, the most unscientific public policy ever perpetuated by the federal government. Now, first of all, some would say you've got a lot of competition there, but let's have you defend it anyway.
Well, you know, I used to think that daylight saving and the so-called hour we were saving was a theoretical idea. But the more I actually researched it, I understood no one had seriously proposed a theory for saving an hour. Here's what it is. It's a philosophical idea. We are supposed to pretend, to philosophize, that when we move our clocks forward, we are losing an hour in the spring, and that we actually gain it. There has been a 100-year policy debate about the meaning, the effect, the environmental utility of an item and a quantity which we absolutely know has never existed. So I think it doesn't quite rise to the point of being a scientific proposal.
Well, that's great. Very good. Well, thank you, Michael. We're out of time, and we really appreciate it. It's an enjoyable read, and I would certainly recommend it to our listeners. They could take it out every 6 months and try to figure out what the heck's going on here. So thank you for joining. It does
indeed.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Michael Downing, the author of Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time, published by Shoemaker and Hoard. This is Talking History.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad bags on and join me, hun. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes 1. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight.
Welcome back. Following up on my conversation with Michael Downing on the history of daylight saving time, Carlene Stevens now joins us to offer us her thoughts on Americans and time. Stevens is a curator in the History of Technology Division at the National Museum of American History, Smithsonian Museum. She was also the project director and curator of the museum's permanent exhibition on time, about which we will be hearing more in a moment, and the author of the exhibit's exhibition book of the same title.
Okay, I confess, I'm always running a little bit late. What about you? Are you overscheduled? In a hurry? Racing to beat the clock? Ever pause to wonder how the clock got to be so powerful in our lives? Hours and minutes, quarter till, half past, 7:52 and 3 seconds. The clock dial's imprint on us is so strong that we tend to take no notice of what's behind it. We could care less about the technologies that make the hands rotate or the digits change. We also don't consider for very long the other ways we experience time every day, nature's time signals like the rising and setting sun, and body rhythms like hunger and sleepiness. But the clock wasn't always in charge. In 18th century America, people were powerfully mindful of time, but they found it first in their local religious rituals and in nature's cycles. Only about 10% of the population owned a clock or a watch, and those who did had to set those timepieces with a sundial. After about 1820, more people wanted to own clocks and watches, and an American industry to make them was born. And still more people experienced the mechanical regularity and insistent pace of the clock, especially in industry, in cities, and railroading. The American railroads helped build a national economy and a national standard time. In 1883, they abandoned 50-some complicated regional operating times to impose coordinated time zones on their routes across the continent. You know, Eastern, Central, Mountain, and Pacific time. Clocks no longer set to the sun overhead, instead were synchronized to the new system. A generation after that, the country became obsessed with using time even more efficiently. Like it or not, efficiency experts used factory punch clocks and stopwatches to standardize work, to increase productivity. Zealously, these experts advocated time-saving measures for nearly every other aspect of American life, too, not just at work, but also at home. Even leisure, time off, became defined by the clock. Today, when time seems scarce, we try to squeeze more minutes out of every day. We push our work and leisure 24/7, around the clock, into hours we formerly reserved for sleep. We schedule our nonstop days to take advantage of every minute. Even the second, split into unimaginably tiny pieces, seems longer and more important. After 300 years, it's clear that clocks and watches have changed from less accurate to more accurate, from luxuries to necessities, and from rarities to our ubiquitous companions.
You've been listening to Carlene Stevens, a curator in the History of Technology Division at the National Museum of American History, Smithsonian Museum, the project director and curator of the museum's permanent exhibit, On Time, and the author of the exhibit's exhibition book of the same title, published by Bullfinch Press. And finally, I mentioned earlier in my introduction of Carlene Stevens that she was the curator of the National Museum of American History's permanent exhibit, On Time. Here to tell you about that exhibition is Talking History's Fiona Beattie.
Dost thou love life? Then do not squander time, for that is the stuff life is made of. So said Benjamin Franklin, who, being a man conscious of time, promoted the idea of daylight savings in a letter to a Parisian newspaper. His proposal didn't catch on, but the notion of measuring time and maximizing its use has been around for a long, well, time. In 1999, on the 116th anniversary of standard railway time, when uniform time was adopted in America, the Smithsonian National Museum of American History Baring Center opened a 4,000-square-foot permanent exhibition called On Time. Both the virtual and physical exhibitions seek to generate an awareness of how Americans have viewed time over the past 300 years, from the era when the passage of time was marked by the rising and setting of the sun, to today's 24/7, 365 time-driven society. In addition to a marvelous collection of clocks and timepieces, artifacts in the exhibit include an almanac created by Benjamin Banneker, a free African-American farmer and inventor, and the Gilbreth Management Desk, just what every household manager wanted in 1933, sporting a clock, radio, telephone, adding machine, charts, books and files, and intended for the kitchen. And just what did a horse called Lexington have to do with time? I leave it to you to find out at americanhistory.si.edu.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beattie is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.